Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Sandy Allen's Uncle Bob lived a hard, lonely life. He was in and out of mental hospitals while growing up in the 60s and 70s. He was often heavily medicated and lived a mostly solitary life as an adult, interacting only rarely on family vacations. Bob and Sandy didn't really know each other that well, but late in his life, he turned to Sandy for help with an intimate and monumental task: getting his story told. That request took Sandy on a long emotional journey, and the result is the book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. Sandy Allen is a graduate of the University of Iowa nonfiction writing program and will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. and is with me on the line. Hello, Sandy.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And let's start off with just reading the first page or so of the book, because it's the perfect introduction to what happened.
Sure. So this first chapter is called Genesis. It's a bit of a joke from me. Late one hot summer night several years ago, I got a call from a number that wasn't in my phone. I had recently moved to the Midwest for graduate school and was at a party in someone's living room. I wouldn't usually answer such a call, but in recent days I'd met and given my number to a lot of people. I found a bedroom and, shutting the door behind me, answered, "Hey man, how you doing?" It was my uncle, my mom's older brother, Bob. Though I couldn't tell you when we'd last spoken, I recognized his voice right away. Bob had been a teenager in Berkeley in the 60s, and his voice sounded stuck there. He sprinkled his sentences with, "Yeah, man," and "right on," and "far out." He laughed a lot. His was a wild, wheezing laugh, and given that he was a smoker, his laughs would often devolve into a loud hack. "Hey, Bob," I said. I set my glass on a dresser and flicked on a light. He asked if I'd moved yet, and I said yes. Some relative must have told him that, and that I was studying writing. "Hey, I wrote a book, man. I wrote the story of my life," he said. "Is that right?" He talked for a while. He asked for my new address, and without much thought, I gave it to him. I told him I had to go, though. "Oh, all right. Sorry, man," he said, and repeated several times, "Thank you, Sandy. Thanks, man." It was unclear what he was thanking me for or what I had agreed to do. "It's totally fine," I said, and, hanging up, quickly forgot about the conversation altogether.
Now, before we talk about what you had apparently agreed to do in that phone conversation, tell me what you remember about your Uncle Bob from when you were a kid.
Yeah, Bob was a sort of fringe relative, you know, in the cast of characters that I would meet occasionally at these summer gatherings in northern Minnesota. I grew up in California, but we'd go to the lake and all the family would be together, and Bob was, you know, a little different. He wore long sleeves, he had thick glasses, he smoked a lot, he played guitar, and it was clear that the people in the family regarded him a little different. Like, he didn't have kids, he didn't have a wife, you know, a lot of other people had those things. But I really liked him when I was a child. I thought he was funny. You know, he was always cracking jokes, he was always laughing, and he was a musician, and I'm a creative person. I was a singer, and so I was someone who enjoyed sitting next to him, you know, before dinner, and we would kind of improvise songs together and so forth. He would send my mom, who was his little sister, you know, he would leave us voicemails. He would, sometimes he would send us cassette tapes with his new songs, or he would play a whole song into our answering machine. So that was sort of his presence in my world. It was pretty minimal, though I was curious about him. I had some questions. You know, I'd heard, for example, from my mom, you know, or perhaps others in the family, that he was crazy, which was the word that they would have used. And I was really curious about what that meant, or like what had happened to him. But as I write in the book, you know, when I tried to ask my mom about those things, her answers were pretty unsatisfactory. So I had a mild curiosity about Bob, but then as I grew up, I honestly kind of forgot about him.
You had other things going on.
Yeah, he stopped calling. I was growing up, you know. I visited him once when I was an adult, which was a couple years before he sent me the manuscript.
Well, and as you mentioned, I mean, you grew up in California. Bob also grew up in California and lived in California most of his entire life. So it's funny that you saw him on summer vacations in Minnesota, but you didn't live that far away from him in California, and you didn't really see him there.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, California's big. We were
right.
Like 3 hours apart. But yeah, I mean, and I write about this in the beginning of the book. Like, I think I on some level assumed he must have lived quite far away, because the idea of going to see him never came up during the course of my childhood. And so, you know, this book, in trying to understand his life and his diagnosis and some of the experiences he had, part of what I think I was initially just trying to understand was, why is there this difference between how, you know, we regard everybody else in the family and how we regard this one person?
And you mentioned that your mom said he was crazy, and you did ask your mom, you know, what's the deal with Uncle Bob? And that's really the extent of what she told you?
Yeah, I mean, she didn't have a lot of good info about her brother. You know, I think that's one of those things that we come to sort of see in three dimensions through the course of the story, is sort of why various people understood what they did about Bob. And in my mom's case, she was his much younger sister, and she was basically the kids were split up as the parents split up. So my mom and her sister lived with their mom, and Bob and his dad lived together when Bob was initially hospitalized. So when Bob was going through that first experience of being brought to a public mental hospital when he was about 16 years old in 1970, and this is all happening in Berkeley, California, my mom wasn't in the same household as her brother. And so there is an extent to which she just wasn't a really good source of information about what had happened to him. I would also say, just personality-wise, she and I are a little different. I'm the kind of person who really wants to know, you know, what's the history of this? What's the science behind it? You know, I want to understand the whole situation. And I think my mom was someone who was much less inclined to ask questions. And so this book is, in a sense, it's me asking more people than just her, you know, than just the person who I was immediately connected to in the family.
So let's get back to that phone call. You talked to Bob. He thanked you so much for agreeing to do whatever it is that you'd said that you would do.
Sure.
And just a few days later, a package arrived from him. Tell me what it was.
Yeah, so he'd mailed me this envelope. Inside the envelope was this stack of paper. And before I saw it, I smelled it, you know. The cigarette smoke just comes out of the envelope at me. And inside is this stack of paper. It's about 60 pages all told. And he's typed it on a typewriter in mostly all capital letters. And he's mostly punctuated it with colons. And it's very misspelled, and there's no paragraphs, so there's sort of these walls of text. And right away, I'm running into, like, profanity. I'm running into racist slurs. Like, I was just like, whoa, what is this, you know? Very, very turned off. I put it back in an envelope, and I put it in a drawer, and I was just like, I don't want to deal with this. You know, I was worried about what other people in the family would think if I were to help Bob with something he wanted me to. But I had no interest in helping him. I was like, what is this gross thing you've sent me, you know? And honestly, and as I describe in the top of the book, I would have thrown it out, you know, but it was a typewritten original. And I think I felt a little guilty, you know, because it was clear that he had spent, you know, at the very least, you know, whatever it was, he had spent a long time, obviously, sitting at his typewriter, putting the whole thing together.
Did you feel a little bit, I don't know, frustrated? Like, this is my uncle. We're not that close. How could he lay this on me?
Yeah, I mean, and I think if you're a writer, I'm not sure if this happens to people of other professions, but people are always sort of handing you ideas, like as if that's what you want, you know? Like, just yesterday, someone was like, there's an idea for your second book, and I was like, please don't. so I think there was an extent to which I was just like, yeah, you know, this is just some relative with some thing he wants me to help him with, and there's no way I'm ever going to do it. You know, that would have been my opinion on day one. And we spoke on the phone, Bob and I, after I did actually read the whole narrative that he'd written out, or I kind of tried to, we spoke on the phone, and I, at that that point would have been trying to sort of like, I would have been trying to show him that it was a bad idea to go forward with this. You know, I was just like, hey, Bob, but mostly because it was so unreasonable to me that anyone would ever have any interest in hearing his story. You know, I was just trying to let him down gently. Like, I had no intention of helping him, and I knew that the world would never have any appetite for what he had written down. So I came into this with an extreme pessimism about the possibility that this story had anything to tell the world, frankly. And over time, of course, I came to change my mind quite a bit. And well, I think the book tells that story, too.
Right. And you say you read it. But, I mean, give us an idea of how difficult this was to read. I mean, you already mentioned how it was written mostly in all caps with terrible spelling and bad punctuation. And it was kind of a block of text. But it also... You only quote short parts of it in your book. I mean, it must have just been really difficult to follow.
Initially, it must have been. And now, if I look at those pages, I know how to read them, right? Like, sort of like if you can read sheet music or if you read another language. Like, I do think at this point I just speak Bob. And that just that was because I spent so many years, you know, in Iowa City in my little apartment with Bob's pages and my laptop open and kind of thinking about, well, how can I tell this story in a way that people can hear it? Because, yes, his text when I first tried to read it was really hard to parse. But other than that, and some of its really off-putting characteristics, which I mentioned, there was also something really incredible going on in this story. And I think back then I couldn't have described what was incredible about it. I just felt it. And I think as an artist, I had this curiosity to just kind of try to figure out how to communicate that on so that more people could sort of hear some of this story. You know, I remember the first time I read that sequence of him being hospitalized the first time at Herrick Hospital, you know, the way he renders it. And I was so affected by it. I was feeling all this emotion for Bob, you know, and I think in that moment realized how I had never felt anything for this person. I had regarded him as such an other, even someone in my own family, you know, but also people like him, you know, people who we see in our society who we associate with an idea like crazy or like mentally ill, you know. So I think I was starting to sort of punch through or at least encounter that sort of bigotry that I had been taught to hold against someone who's labeled crazy, labeled insane, or what have you. And I just really, truly never thought through what that experience would be like of being tossed in that cell at age 16 and injected with antipsychotics and kind of left there.
We'll talk more about that in just a moment. We do need to take a short break. I'm talking with Sandy Allen, the author of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. They've written this book about their uncle, Bob, who was diagnosed as schizophrenic as a teenager. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Sandy Allen, and we're talking about their book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. As we were talking about in the last segment of the show, Sandy received a manuscript from Uncle Bob that detailed his life as someone who was diagnosed with schizophrenia as a teenager, in and out of mental hospitals in the 60s and 70s, often heavily medicated. He lived the life of a hermit, a long, hard, lonely life. And Sandy Allen was in Iowa City studying nonfiction writing when they received this manuscript. And Sandy, I want to pick up where we left off. When you opened that manuscript, the first thing on the front page of the manuscript, there's a paragraph that just says, "I'm Robert. This is a true story of a boy brought up in Berkeley, California during the 60s and 70s who was unable to identify with reality and therefore labeled as a psychotic, paranoid schizophrenic for the rest of his life." First of all, when you read that paragraph, was that the first time you'd heard the term schizophrenia associated with your uncle?
possible. Yeah, it's possible I'd heard it before, you know, sort of in the family, you know, at some point. But I do remember being quite struck by the concision that Bob uses on his cover page of his manuscript. And in that, you really have the whole issue at hand, you know, as Bob phrases it, labeled as a psychotic paranoid schizophrenic. And this other phrase, which, you know, I thought about, I still think about, unable to identify with reality. These were some of the big questions that I was having as I started to figure out how to translate this project into a form that I thought more people might be willing to engage with, you know, which was, what do we mean here, unable to identify with reality? And what is this label, you know, right, psychotic, paranoid, schizophrenic?
The use of the word labeled implies that Bob didn't accept it.
Right. It implies something, right? Mm-hmm. Either a misdiagnosis or, as I would come to understand, an actually even bigger debate about the validity of that diagnosis to begin with. And that was one of those questions that it was 8 years all told that I worked on this book. But it was for about the first five, I really didn't do anything but sit with Bob's story. I tried to read about schizophrenia. I went down to the Iowa University Library and checked out various books and read all these books about the history of schizophrenia and the history of psychiatry and the history of anti-psychiatry and so on. And I just really couldn't tell up from down. And I found myself so much less interested in kind of like these big debates and more interested in what Bob had to say. And so I just spent all these years really just trying to tell his story, because I found that to be such an important point of view that I didn't really find what represented, you know, in what I was discovering at the library, for example, at that point, but also just in our world. You know, I all the time I saw sort of mention of like this figure of the schizophrenic or the crazy person or the mentally ill person in our pop culture, in the news. But so rarely were those impressions coming from anything except stereotype. And Bob's account of his own life, you know, it totally changed my perception of that word, schizophrenic, you know, or a word like psychotic, which I think are ones that we are really, we are taught by our culture to fear, you know.
Well, let's, you unraveled the threads and learned about Bob's life. So let's talk about what we do know about Bob. So you mentioned the divorce, and your grandparents had a very ugly, contentious divorce. And when your grandfather moved into his own place, initially the kids stayed with your grandmother, but eventually Bob moved in with your grandfather. Why did he move in with his dad?
Yeah, you know, that was one of those questions I'd always had. I'd even asked my mom about that when I was little. You know, why were you and your sister in one home and your brother was in another home? So in my creation of this project, eventually I did, you know, get the publisher contract, and then I went and really reported it out. You know, I was interviewing everybody in the family finally who would talk to me, and asking them, how do you remember this and how do you remember that, and really trying to understand some of these family things that I had never grasped, like this one. You know, what was happening in this household that Bob and his mom were separated from each other, or that Bob preferred to live with his dad. And, you know, what I really found was, in general, regarding this sort of family stuff, everybody had a different perception of reality. And in A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, I'm telling all of these incompatible truths, you know. So whether we're thinking about schizophrenia or we're thinking about the particularities of the divorce, the version of reality that you hear really depends on who you ask. And so in general, Bob was someone who was coming up in a household where there was a lot of fighting, and he was coming up in a world where there was a lot of fighting. It was Berkeley. It was the 60s and early 70s. There was integration in the schools. There was all this sort of visible cultural cataclysm in the streets. And he was someone who was clearly, you know, struggling in school, and I think also bullied. And then he ends up with just his dad, and that seems to have something to do with him fighting with his mom. And I should also mention, this was the kind of stuff where, you know, when I went to my family and said, hey, I'm finishing this book, and it's about Bob, and it's going to tell his truth, you know, it was a really complicated project, and this was some really sensitive stuff that I was digging into with, you know, relatives of mine, some of whom are pretty old. And so it was really tricky. I wasn't just a reporter. I was also, you know, a member of the family and someone who was really conscious of honestly what things couldn't go in this book, you know, that weren't ultimately gonna serve the story, and they were just gonna hurt real people. I had to make a lot of really tough calls.
Yeah.
But what's clear is Bob was a kid who was quite isolated from others. And if we're gonna think about big takeaways about schizophrenia or mental health, I think that's an important one to underscore. He was in that formative, you know, age. Kind of like adolescence, you know, teenage years, and he really didn't have anybody looking out for him. If anything, he had a lot of people who were fighting him. And I think he was also someone who, you know, had always struggled to fit in. And the older he got, the more that became something that was really actively challenging him.
Well, and the time, I mean, the 60s and 70s, I think in this day and age, we kind of romanticize it a little bit, the time when, oh, kids were allowed to, you know, play outside until dark and things like that. But as you mentioned, I mean, nobody was really keeping tabs on him. And when things started to go wrong, nobody was saying, hey, what's going on with you? There was discipline. He was getting in trouble.
Yeah. And then there was a hospital, you know, and I think that was one of those things that all those years I'd sat there with Bob's manuscript by myself, and I'd wanted to know, you know, what did my grandfather remember of this time? Like, what did my grandfather make of Bob? And, like, why did he take him to the hospital? Because in Bob's account, there really isn't some reason he's taken to the hospital. And when I finally interviewed my grandfather, he didn't remember the first time he brought Bob to the hospital. You know, like, his memory of these events was so different. For Bob, that first hospitalization was this traumatic incident that is so, I mean, even just the amount of space he gives, you know, telling that particular story, it really takes up a lot of his whole image of himself, you know, that first hospitalization. But to my grandfather, he didn't even remember that. Now, what I will say is that's what the society had on offer for a young person who was struggling, was you drive them to a mental hospital, you know, once
and
they're inside,
they're
going to get, you know, the clothes will get changed out, and they'll get put in a cell, and they'll get injected with medications and so on, you know, and I think that that's part of what my book ends up contemplating. Not what was wrong with Bob so much as what was wrong with the society around Bob. You know, how was Bob kind of set up to fail by the society around him? And was the solution that he was offered by his father, and this isn't a judgment of his father did, I think, and this was one of the things that was so clear, especially in my conversations with all of the adults who had to care for Bob, you know, they did the best they could. Everybody did the very best they could, whether that was, you know, initially it was a public mental hospital, later it was private psychiatric hospitals and doctors, and it was a lot of psychiatric medications. You know, these weren't remedies that they were providing out of callousness. These were remedies that they were providing in hopes they would help and fix him, you know? And I wanted to really, in this book, try to show the worldview of not just Bob, but also the caregivers, you know, and to try to understand where the caregivers and where the mental health providers are seeing, how they're seeing this situation and sort of their conception of truth and how it gets constructed as well.
I'm talking with Sandy Allen, the author of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. Sandy has written about their uncle Bob and his life. And you talk about that first hospitalization and reading, you kind of translate Bob's manuscript. So you tell his story and then insert quotes from him as well to make this story more readable, more accessible to us. But that initial account of that first hospitalization is so heartbreaking. I mean, it really feels like it comes straight out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Not that, I mean, Bob was not lobotomized, but he was injected with these sedatives. He was restrained, at least by his account. He was really kept prisoner.
Yeah, I mean, he was psychiatrically incarcerated. You know, that's a term that the activists who I, you know, interview. I do a lot of reporting these days, spending time with people who are involved in trying to create a better, more humane, you know, mental health care system, so to speak. And yeah, he was that would be the term they would use. He was psychiatrically incarcerated, and he was a minor, and it was itself very traumatizing. And I think that it was definitely reading that sequence that initially began to shift something inside of me. You know, some part of me that was not interested in knowing Bob's humanity began to be curious about Bob's humanity, you know, and I think that curiosity would have been what drove me to sort of undertake this creative task of trying to bring the writing itself into a form that was more accessible. The way he wrote, you know, he's not a trained writer, as I was, you know, fortunate to be someone who was attending the University of Iowa to study writing and had just come from college where I'd also studied nonfiction writing. You know, I had that toolkit, but also I had a sense of, you know, the fact that it's really hard to get people to listen to a story that illuminates the humanity of someone who, you know, for reasons of social caste, we have always ignored, you know, we have ignored his truth and we have not been curious about the really tough things that have happened to him. And then what's really clear to me now, especially having spent the last few years reporting on this beat in the U.S. and abroad, is, you know, this is a pretty normal story in the scheme of someone who ends up with a severe mental illness diagnosis in the late 20th century, early 21st, you know. The experiences that Bob had, they're pretty typical, and that sense that he had of being really dehumanized, you know, and his entire personhood was taken captive, you know, and he could no longer ask questions, he could no longer get answers, and that incident of being hospitalized, you know, that's really his entrance into the psychiatric system, and he spends the rest of his life in the psychiatric system, and as a subject of that system, and I think that I had never really thought, you know, as someone who didn't live in that system, I had never really thought through what it would be like to be on the other side.
Well, and in spite of the fact that in some ways your grandfather does not come off as the most sympathetic character in the book, I mean, there definitely were some serious family issues and, as you mentioned, just a lot of rancor, a lot of fighting. But as a parent, I also deeply empathize with him. He didn't know what was going on. Bob had been kicked out of high school. He was using drugs, which, you know, history tells us that the majority of the teenagers in Berkeley in the 1960s and 70s were. But he, you know, he didn't know what was going on with his son, and he didn't know what to do about it. This was an act of last resort.
Yeah, I think he was providing for his son. And, you know, one of the things I'm really trying to honor in this book is his continued role through his son's entire life in caring for him, you know, and that I'm showing that one of the things about Bob is that he was really lucky that he came from a family, he had a dad who could provide for him to the extent that he did. And, you know, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a sequence later on in Bob's story where his dad really is his literal savior. He shows up and really gets Bob out of a tough spot, you know. So I wanted to show how complicated a relationship someone like Bob has with a parent like his dad and his stepmom and his mom, you know, and his doctors. He has these really complicated relationships with people who have a lot of control over his life, who I think also feel very powerless. And I wanted to try to capture, you know, the way that they saw Bob and the way that Bob saw them, because there was such a big difference, you know, in these accounts of reality as I gathered them.
Well, and so there was the first hospitalization that clearly was very traumatic for Bob. There were all of these other tries that your grandfather, you know, would send him to hike in the mountains with a group. That's something that he did for two summers. I feel like he was searching, not just to send Bob away, which there may have been part of that too, but just searching for something that would help.
Yeah, and those hikes happen earlier in his life than that first hospitalization. Yeah. And it's definitely one of those parts of his life that I was really interested to learn more about later, because when I was in that more reporterly phase with the book, I was tracking down people who were mentioned in Bob's manuscript who I didn't know. You know, I was trying to find sometimes people who I thought might not be real, and I was, you know, kind of doing everything I could as a reporter to track down this person or that. And I ended up finding a lot of these, you know, now men, these boys who'd hiked with Bob when they were 14, 15 in the summer on these long trips with these donkeys and stuff. And the way that these guys remembered Bob was so different than the way that people remembered him who knew about stuff like the hospitalizations. And they were all so blown away that I had found them, and they were also curious what had happened to him. You know, they really admired him, and they told me about what a wonderful climber he was and how he baked such wonderful bread. And it, you know, it was really an example of how when you are in a family with someone who has a psychiatric diagnosis, like I was, you know, I heard crazy. That was the word I heard. That was the impression of this person who I received kind of, you know, secondhand. But for people who had a very different encounter with Bob, you know, their perceptions of him weren't the same. And in fact, it was really humbling for me, you know, as someone who had sort of had the one way, I'd already seen him. And I was trying to sort of, you know, make that picture more dimensional. But yeah, I think one of the other sort of big things I'm getting at in writing this book and in my continued work is I want us to be a little more imaginative about what, quote, mental health care could look like. You know, the Appalachian Trail, for example, was created as mental health care in a sense. You know, it was largely for veterans coming back with shell shock. You know, this idea of going on a long hike as a way of restoring the soul. You know, there's a lot of history to that. That's practiced still. And I think throughout the narrative of Bob's life, we have so many examples of helpful and unhelpful things that happened to him. And he is someone who clearly struggled and was vulnerable. And we might debate the sort of like biological nature of that vulnerability, but I think it's perhaps more interesting to think about, well, what are the things that clearly does help him? And one thing is being outside, being close to nature.
And we'll have to pick that thread up in just a moment. So I'm talking with Sandy Allen, the author of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise. Sandy will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m., and we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Sandy Allen, the author of a book, A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. Sandy has written about their uncle Bob, who was diagnosed as schizophrenic as a teenager in and out of mental hospitals while growing up in the 1960s and 70s in Berkeley, California. And Sandy, just before the break, we were talking about the things that did seem to help Bob, the things that didn't seem to help Bob. And there were good treatments that he went through. Although, I mean, one of the things that becomes clear through the book, and I think for anyone who loves someone with a mental illness, they've been on this roller coaster ride. You know, Bob, things would get so bad and he would be divorced from reality and maybe even behaving in scary, near violent ways. He was not violent, but he liked to carry around knives, and that's pretty scary to people around him, especially when he's not making sense. So he would go into treatment and things would get better and he would come out and things would be good for a while. He would be able to hold down a job. He would be able to pay rent on an apartment and live independently. And then things would go off the rails. And often it was when he, or in one case, someone else just threw away his medication and then, you know, things would slide. But also, it's pretty clear that the kind of medication that was available to him was really limited in what it could do. And in so many ways, for people with schizophrenia, that's still the case, right?
Absolutely. You know, this book is about the 70s, but it's about now. And if anything, a lot of the trends that I'm writing about in writing Bob's life have continued in the same direction. So at this point, you know, so the point I was making before the break is like, what can help someone who's struggling? And I think an example is nature, and another example is friends. I mean, that's a big thing that you see in Bob's story is when he falls into a scene where he's got friends, or he's in a band and he's got some friends, or he's on that hike and he has some friends. I mean, that makes a huge difference, right? And so I do think that one of the big points that I'm seeking to make in this book, and it's really a point that Bob made to me, and I'm just repeating it, is I think we can have an expanded repertoire when it comes to how we help people who need this sort of care, right? If medications aren't able to do it, why are we pretending like there will be a medication that will be able to solve? Psychosocial disability can be viewed very differently if we were thinking more about the environment that a person is put in. And you were discussing that, and it's really keen observation. He is on this roller coaster ride as he's in and out of hospitals and he tries to hold down a job or hold down this or that sort of stable situation, housing, et cetera. Over and over he fails. So I think that's another of those sort of big points that we can contemplate. Why are we putting this on Bob? You know, why as a sane society aren't we providing stable housing and dignified work for people with disabilities like my uncle? Because over and over as we read his story, we can sort of tell he's going to fail as he keeps thinking he's sort of figured it all out. And so I think that's one of those exercises that I think those of us who haven't been in that position of being psychiatrically diagnosed can continue to do, is thinking about, well, should we be locating the problem in that individual, or should we be thinking more about the ways in which our society could be better providing for all of us, including somebody who is, breaking from consensus reality and carrying around a knife, you know, for self-protection. That's a thing that happens. So that being the case, what's the best answer for that person? Is it guns and prison? You know, or is it medication only, you know, or are there better ways? And I really think the wisdom that you find if you start listening to people who have been in that situation of needing psychiatric care, you know, the answers that folks like that are advocating for are much more humane and common sense, stuff like housing, stuff like community.
Well, and you mentioned how Bob's friends that may not have even known about his diagnosis, but some who did and, you know, remembered the mental hospitals, the way that they talked about Bob was so different from the way that maybe the family talked about Bob. But even when you think about your childhood memories, I mean, you remember Bob as being charismatic, as being intelligent, as being charming, funny, and, you know, being a gifted musician. I mean, he had a lot to offer.
Yeah.
And that becomes clear throughout his life.
Yeah. And I think that's a big point, is that, you know, we as a society have to decide the value of these diagnoses. And if they're just a net negative, if they're just hurting the individual and the rest of us because they limit our imaginative capabilities when it comes to these people who have been othered in this way, you know, I think there's a big point here, which is a diagnosis limits, you know, and in Bob's case, you have an individual who exceeds the expectation of that diagnosis in so many ways, and I think everybody who knows somebody with the diagnosis knows that that's true. And so maybe that diagnosis has a value in the medical system, but maybe it doesn't, and I think that's one of those big things that I'm seeking to contemplate in this book. And it's one of the reasons that I go into, for example, something like the Hearing Voices movement, which I think is a patient-driven movement that gives us a sort of alternate framework for thinking about something like what the psychiatric community would call psychosis. And so I'm hoping to continue to sort of integrate our discourse around mental health to actually include those individuals like my uncle who've been put in the position of being diagnosed.
Now, some of the stories that your uncle shared in his autobiography, I mean, you can tell when he's not engaging with reality. You know, there were things he thought that he was controlling what people on television were saying. There were many things that he saw as almost miraculous coincidences, but he thought maybe he was in control of these things that were going on in our greater culture. I would love for you to read just a little bit from one of his happier memories of a time in a mental hospital that may be a little hard to believe, although you haven't proved that it didn't happen. But
exactly, you know, and I think that's one of the fun sort of games of this book, because I did try really hard to fact check everything in Bob's story. And one of the things that I say at the end is there's very little that I was able to prove didn't happen to him. Kind of astonishingly little. And when I really was going through and trying to find, you know, what are the holes in his story or what are the ways that it doesn't make sense, even just on a timeline level and so on, it was pretty incredible how watertight his narrative was, you know. So here's an example of, you know, a passage that, gosh, I tried. I tried to confirm or deny this, and I wasn't able. And I don't know if someone who's close with Kenny Rogers is listening, you can check this out for me. But so this comes when Bob is staying at this other hospital that he goes to a bunch of times in the East Bay. It's a private psychiatric facility that has since closed that he calls La Casa Villa. One day on the open unit, he was sitting strumming his 12-string when a guy walked by and complimented his song. "I'm working on a song," the guy said. Bob said, "Great." The guy went and got his guitar, and together they sat on the patio. The guy said the song the guy played was called The Gambler. "That was the coolest thing I've ever heard," Bob said. The guy explained he drove around in a van, and his name was Kenny Rogers. They shook hands. Unfortunately, Kenny wasn't on the same ward or in Bob's same therapy group, but they still managed to hang out and jam a few times. Bob asked Kenny once why he was at the hospital, and all he said was, "I feel rotten." Bob met Kenny's wife and daughter and when they came to visit. Then right before Kenny was released, he played a concert for everybody in the day room and even asked if Bob wanted to play bass on one number. Playing with Kenny Rogers, Bob found, was funner than hell. Bob was grinning big, and one patient burst into tears. She was so moved by their song. Bob later found out that Kenny asked his doctor whether Bob could come with him on tour, but he'd said no. Kenny got out, and Bob never saw him again.
Sandy Allen reading from A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. And as you said, you could not confirm nor deny that particular story. But I am curious, you reported this story. You fact-checked your uncle's autobiography,
yeah.
Which seems...
I wrote a lot of emails to publicists who I had reason to believe were related to Kenny Rogers. Like, I really tried to check that point.
What made you decide to fact-check his story? Because so much of it did sound like fantasy.
Well, I think first, I have an obligation as a nonfiction writer, right? I think to try to track down what's true and what's not true and be clear with my reader in as much as I'm able to do so. In this book, there's a lot more questions than answers, right? Like that's the realm we're in here. And I think that's fitting because that's what's up in the realm of madness generally. There's a lot that we, society or that science, the medical community, doesn't actually know about some of the very biggest stuff at hand when we're thinking about what to do with an individual, in our human family who seems to be mad. And I think that I was really, for a while, unsure, what my obligation was to my eventual reader vis-a-vis all these things that Bob said about himself. I didn't want to just be passing off, lies or things that were obviously inaccurate as nonfiction. And I also had this real obligation to try to explain to my reader in a way that would be intelligible. What do we know, from a medical point of view about something like schizophrenia or about the nature of these psychiatric medications, So I wanted to be clear with my reader that we are in the realm of truth, and that I have done my due diligence as a reporter and as a nonfiction writer to, really, really give you something that you can trust. And so that's why I decided to take Bob's manuscript that seriously, but also because I think I wanted to really challenge a base assumption that so many of us who haven't received a diagnosis like schizophrenia have when it comes to people who have received a diagnosis like schizophrenia, which is we don't trust them. We've decided such people are unbelievable. And is that fair? Is it fair to presume that someone with a schizophrenia diagnosis is untrustworthy? Because I think that's a value judgment, right, as well. We've decided someone, we don't want to give them the same sort of trust, And I wanted to really push back against that because I think there's a bigotry in there. There's a mean thing, that I think a lot of the rest of us, the sane, those of us who've never been in the position of being tossed in that psychiatric cell and given that diagnosis of schizophrenia, we need to really think through our biases and what it keeps us from seeing.
Well, and it's striking that Bob's version of what happened was more reliable than the versions you were able to get from either one of his parents or his siblings.
In a sense, I will say this, I find his account more interesting. He was there. And I do think that just in general, right, when we're thinking about systems and we're thinking about oppression, whose voices are least likely to be heard? Whose reality is least likely to be confirmed? Whose pain is least likely to be recognized? And I do think in this book I'm trying to flip a hierarchy. Rather than merely trusting the sort of point of view of professionals, I am listening to the person whose voice has been actively suppressed in so many ways by our society.
You also have a story that really sheds a lot of light on the power of privilege. There's a moment when you're talking with your grandfather and you know, I think you bring up just the term schizophrenia, and your grandfather's like, well, that's not really Bob. I mean, schizophrenics are people who are in downtown San Francisco talking to light posts. And it was this gut-wrenching moment, because if your grandfather hadn't had the privileges that he had, if he hadn't had the money to be able to take care of his son in the way that he did take care of him, Bob could have very easily been in downtown San Francisco talking to light posts.
Exactly, right? And that's a real point. That's an important point that I think we all need to think about. This schizophrenia thing, you know, madness more broadly, it is part of the human condition. And we actually don't have a lot. We don't have the ability to see who is going to end up needing mental health care, right? There is no big separation between the insane and the sane, on the other hand. You know, those of us who will never need mental health care, and people like my uncle. Now, did he have need? Absolutely. But it's clear that, you know, these categories, and because these categories, like a word like schizophrenic, has such a negative cast to it, you know, that is keeping even someone who, in my grandfather, was so close to someone who had that diagnosis, but still had trouble understanding the negative power of his son having been put in that group socially. And one of the things that I'm doing in this story generally is simply adding my uncle's point of view to that whole truth equation, you know, not just letting kind of the more professional and buttoned-up and trustworthy-seeming people kind of create the reality system, but allowing Bob's voice to sort of have a piece of it too. Because, you know, in my grandfather in that moment, I agree, right? It's really telling, and I think it shows how even someone like him doesn't really have a good purchase on the whole situation, you know, and how I think all of us, even those of us who are maybe, you know, someone like me who's not very close to this topic to begin with, or someone who is really close to this topic to begin with, we can maybe stand to learn more. Our position in this greater system, you know, might keep us from sort of seeing important pieces of it.
What do you want your readers to take away from this experience of reading this book?
Well, here's my cheeky answer. I want people to read this book. You know, I really think that people who have never bothered to spend time thinking about what life would be like for someone like my uncle, I think can stand to do it. And I really hope I've made it easy and pleasurable in a way, you know, to sort of ride along co-pilot to Bob's life, because I think there's something so vital in just trying to experience, you know, this point of view that you have really perhaps never been encouraged to experience before.
Your uncle did not live to see this book, although in some ways his absence made it possible for you to tell the story.
Yeah, it's really sad. You know, I cry about Bob still. And I think about him all the time. And if I'm being honest, you know, he was a Christian. I'm not a Christian, but he really was. He was, as he put it, a big believer in heaven. And so I definitely know that if I believe him, he's looking at all this, he's watching the whole thing, he's delighting in it all. And there are members of my family, you know, who will say that sort of stuff to me. You know, they're like, Bobby sees this, you know, he's seeing all this. And I definitely feel like everything I'm doing is something he set me up to do. You know, this all feels like some big plan he had, and I'm really just I'm finishing something he started.
Sandy, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. This has been wonderful.
Sandy Allen is the author of A Kind of Miraculous Paradise, a true story about schizophrenia. And Sandy will be reading at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.